Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor, I'm the Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here. So amidst the current chaos across our global political systems, not to mention in Westminster itself, we've scheduled tonight's event in a spirit of optimism. Here at the RSA, that may be the most optimistic thing you'll hear for the rest of the evening. But anyway, here at the RSA, we work to unite people and ideas to address society's multiple pressing challenges. We've been looking in our research at the growing evidence from around the world that a devolution of power, on the one hand, and involving citizens in the democratic process and doing those things together, can lead to more effective decision-making and accountability. Our focus this evening is how a robust deliberative system can enhance representative democracy and help us resolve the seemingly intractable issue of climate change. This complex and long-term concern requires radical interventions to rebalance our economy as well as our politics towards a more equitable and sustained shared future. Now, I'm delighted to welcome this evening's distinguished speakers to help us explore the system change required to address these urgent challenges and the relationship between democratic reform and the environmental crisis. So our two speakers are Caroline Lucas, MP, and Professor David Runciman. Caroline is MP for Brighton Pavilion. She was leader of the Green Party between September 2008 and September 2012 and co-leader with Jonathan Bartley from September 2016 to September 2018. She's also a member of Parliament's Environmental Audit Committee. Responding to Caroline will be David, Professor of Politics at the University of Cambridge, head of the Department of Politics and International Studies. He's a director of the Leverhulme-funded Conspiracy and Democracy Research Project. He writes about politics for London Review of Books, and if you don't listen to his weekly podcast, Talking Politics, then, well, I don't know what you're doing, really, with your time. apart from the RSA series, Polarised, it is the best thing that you can listen to, so I strongly encourage you to do that. So Caroline's going to speak for around 20 minutes. David's going to respond. I might ask a couple of questions, and then we're going to open up to the rest of you. So please now join me in welcoming Caroline Lucas.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew, for that very kind introduction. I'm really delighted to be here tonight because I want this evening to talk about two issues that are very dear to my heart and I know dear to the heart of the RSA and many of its fellows. That is the environmental emergency and the crisis afflicting liberal democracy. And I want to seek to persuade you that we are more likely to respond to the emergency if we also address the crisis. I'm delighted that David is here as well, a really strong voice, a particularly eloquent and cogent voice among many who have analysed the state of liberal democracy and its currently rather poor prospects. In little more than a generation, we've gone from the fall of the Berlin Wall and Francis Fukuyama's famous assertion that history had ended with the triumph of liberal democracy. We've gone from that to the rise around the world of the three P's of polarization, populism, and pessimism. In the disaster of Brexit, with the basement levels of approval for our major party leaders, unprecedented in modern times, and in the sense that government is unable to tackle some of the most important issues we face, I think we in England and in the UK have our own version of these democratic ills. Inequality is entrenched. Social mobility has stalled, public services are crumbling, and all around us are signs of social stress, from violent crime to higher levels of mental illness. And I think whatever happens now with Brexit, there is little evidence that the underlying anger and resentment that fueled it has subsided. Things are bad. But with the effects of Brexit still to play out, with the wounds of this appallingly handled process still raw, with the underlying causes still untouched, and with right-wing populists ever ready to exploit the situation, I fear that things could get even worse. So there seem to be two main ways that commentators have responded to the problems besetting liberal democracy. And the first is to treat it as little more than a bump in the road. For liberal warriors like Steven Pinker, who spoke here at the RSA last year, it can seem that we have nothing to be worried about but worry itself. People are healthier, they're better off, they're more tolerant, more peaceful than at any time in our history. To overcome public disillusionment, we merely need to reassert the benefits of market democracies and stop listening to self-serving critics and populists. And in a way, that's not a view that should be ignored. In many ways, people today do have opportunities and a quality of life that a few generations ago would have been viewed with amazement by many. If we want to have hope for the future, it's clear that we do need to acknowledge the progress of the past. And in particular, I think we should recall the achievements of the post-war era, when brave governments rebuilt nations out of the ashes of war, when they increased living standards, they grew modern welfare states and laid the foundations for the personal freedoms and legal rights that we now cherish. But nevertheless, I reject the implicit complacency of that view and its lack of ambition. It misses out the plight of the world's poorest billion. It misses the way our own and other liberal democracies have in recent decades, and particularly the period since the credit crunch, been scarred by entrenched inequality, by rising insecurity and the devastation of our public services. But also, I reject it because this story of continuous progress has a cruel twist. The growing and devastating impact of market-led economic growth on our environment and the looming climate crisis. The alternative view is more gloomy. It sees no way back for liberal democracy. It predicts a future which involves ever greater polarization and social conflict, leading eventually to some kind of breakdown. One perhaps in which the role of democracy is downgraded and society is increasingly run by a technocratic elite who may or may not have benign intentions. A kind of one-party rule by Google or Facebook, if you like. And indeed, there are some in the environment movement itself who watch the growing commitment of China to tackle environmental harms and climate change, and then in despair turn their eyes across the Atlantic at a country that increasingly accepts the reality of climate change, but has put a proud denier in office. Now, the evidence used to suggest that democracies were lower emitters, that they were better at taking steps on climate change than authoritarian regimes. But recent research from the University of Gothenburg argues that that's only the case in well-functioning democracies free from corruption. So the point is that it's not simply being notionally democratic that is enough. It's also the quality of that democracy that matters. And that's why I adopt a slightly different position on the crisis of liberal democracy. I think the way to save it is to keep its core principles, of course, free and fair elections, the rule of law, freedom of speech and association, but fundamentally to change the way it works. Now, the Green Democratic Reform agenda is broad with a number of important elements. We support a fairer electoral system, which would, among other things, mean that I wasn't the only person at the Green Party's Christmas party. More seriously, it would mean voters get to choose between genuinely different views, rather than differences being played out in internal party conflict. Historians looking back on this era will ask themselves how an affluent country of intelligent people allowed the internal pathologies of its political parties to determine so much of its fate. And the Green Party also supports lowering the voting age to 16 as a small step to tackling intergenerational injustice and to giving a say to those who have the most to lose by our failure to tackle future threats. And I think, David, that you have advocated going down to a voting age of 6. And while I kind of follow your argument, I have to admit that's a bit too radical even for me. We support greater devolution of power, so decisions are made closer to people, and so progressive leaders have the freedom and the capacity to experiment with enabling more sustainable ways of working and living. After all, around the world, it has consistently been mayors rather than prime ministers and presidents who have grasped the climate challenge. But this evening, I want to focus on one specific aspect of reform, which I know is going to be the subject of an RSA campaign this year. Because I believe that a significant expansion of the use of deliberative methods can both help to renew our ailing democracy and enable us to tackle some of the biggest challenges, of which, of course, protecting and restoring our environment and tackling the accelerating climate crisis are the greatest and the most urgent. Now, speaking to an audience in an organisation that is already involved in a national campaign for deliberation, I don't need to spend much time explaining the nuts and bolts. In essence, deliberation involves a group of citizens who broadly reflect the makeup and the beliefs of the place in question, spending time hearing and interrogating a full range of options and working together to reach shared opinions. But I want to explain why I think the principles of deliberation are so important and so relevant, particularly when it comes to the environment crisis. Before I do so, I should acknowledge, of course, that there is another alternative, and that is the greater use of referenda. But if Brexit has taught us anything, and we could debate that for quite a long time, if it has taught us anything, it is surely that referenda should be used only in those rare circumstances where an issue is basically binary and where the direct implications of a decision can be known in advance. And as we all know, much to our cost, that was not the case with Brexit. Our primary form of democracy is representative, and I'm certainly not suggesting today that deliberation should replace or supplant representation. But I do believe that it can help enhance the role and the effectiveness of representation by addressing some of its failings. Now, these are failings which citizens were perhaps willing to overlook when politics was more class-based, when people were more optimistic, perhaps, and when we had lower expectations of choice in the rest of our lives. But the world has changed, and so must democracy. Because in many ways, representative democracy is an incredibly blunt instrument, especially so under first past the post. Every 5 years, a government is elected, generally with the votes of fewer than a third of the population, on the basis of a take-it-or-leave-it manifesto containing hundreds of policies. And then in power, governments have to respond to a whole new set of issues that they never even thought about before. Now, generally, we prefer shopping to politics. But as Matthew said in his annual lecture last year, imagine what we would think of supermarkets if we had to elect a single brand every 5 years, and then we were not only compelled to use that store, but it could decide what to put in our shopping basket and how much it wanted to charge us for it. A cruel irony of our system is the perception that as soon as people become formal representatives, they enter the political bubble and cease to be representative of ordinary citizens. Now, such a perception may seem harsh, but it does contain truth, and in one aspect particularly. Because generally, politicians, and certainly those with any ambition, are in their day-to-day dealings more beholden to their parties than they are to the electorate. And yet, in terms of values, habits, and makeup, political parties are highly unrepresentative of the public at large. And yes, this is true even of the Greens as well, although we have our debates in public rather than behind closed doors, and we have a structure that deliberately disperses power throughout the party. But I believe democratic deliberation addresses both of these flaws head on. First, it can, in key areas, help to provide a direct mandate, not only strengthening accountability, but legitimising the kind of difficult choices on issues from social care funding to drug laws that many politicians otherwise find hard to, or try hard to, avoid. Second, bringing the views of so-called ordinary citizens into the heart of policy addresses the problem of representatives not being particularly representative. Citizens' juries, like legal juries, one of our few historic institutions that have not come under sustained reputational attack, they rely on simple and powerful assumption by the public, namely that if I had heard the same evidence, I would have reached the same conclusion. And if that sounds unrealistic, then the great thing about deliberation is that there is now a wealth of evidence from around the world stretching back many years, both of its value as a process and as a source of good recommendations. Now, of course, I'm particularly keen on those examples which underline my point about deliberation favouring sustainability. And so, for example, there was the deliberative process in Texas in the late 90s, where following detailed briefing and extended discussion, the understanding of renewable energy and support for them went up substantially. And it resulted in the state going from among the worst to among the best in the US in terms of renewable energy. Or the project in Zegu Township, China, where participants were presented with a set of 30 infrastructure projects, ranging from roads to schools to gardens, with the promise that 10 to 12 of those most favoured projects would go ahead and be built. And the top projects consisted of 8 environmental projects and 1 road-related project. The township appointed an official dedicated to environmental affairs, and indeed the infrastructural projects were then carried out. And of course, deliberation has been used successfully on all sorts of other issues. Last year, a citizens' jury on the future of social care was commissioned by 2 common select committees and organised by the charity Involve. Its recommendations were widely deemed to be sensible, fair, and a great deal bolder than existing policy. Deliberation, I think, can also iron out the problems with direct democracy. It helped make the referendum about constitutional reform and abortion law reform in Ireland, which could have been and would have been very divisive, I think much more positive and unifying. And I think we could certainly make the case that if we had held a deliberative process before the Brexit referendum, I'm pretty sure it would have identified the need for example, a vote at the end of the process of the negotiation as well. But there are particular reasons why I believe that deliberation tends to help make the case for green measures. And I'm not alone in this. A National Citizens Convention is one of the 3 core demands, interestingly, of the Extinction Rebellion movement. And that's for 3 reasons. First, there's the ability to explore an issue in depth, enabling people to understand choices and trade-offs more clearly. As Ben Page from Moray used to say, what people want is simple. They want Scandinavian welfare on American taxes. Deliberation helps people see that addressing long-term issues often requires hard choices. Now, I absolutely believe the ways that we can save the planet are also ways to make our world a better place to live. But that doesn't mean that we can always avoid hard choices. Second, while the pursuit of votes in representative democracies can often lead to kind of a retail politics in which parties seek to outbid each other in buying off certain sections of the electorate, deliberation, by contrast, gives a voice to a genuine cross-section of the community, putting the onus on finding solutions that work for everyone. And third, ownership. Ownership is a tendency of deliberation that people start off blaming the government, but end up recognising that citizens themselves have to accept changes in our assumptions and the way that we live. Now, environmentalism is not something that should be done to people. It is something which should be done with people and which should, in the process, give citizens fresh agency and hope. So I believe that if we are to successfully get off the collision course that we are currently on with climate breakdown, then we need to do it in a way that is fully democratic. And if we're to do that, we urgently need to see the establishment of citizens' assemblies to draw up the plans that would have widespread public consent. That doesn't mean that environmentalists will always get what they want from the process. That clearly is not how democracy works. A deliberation in Japan after Fukushima, for example, recommended shifting from nuclear power by 2030, but it also recommended that the security of energy supply was a more immediate priority than carbon reductions. But there is a broader point here, which goes to my ambitions for the Green Party and the broader movement. Because our commitment to fundamental democratic reform is a signal. It's a signal of our determination to tackle the perception that as a party, our ambitions are narrow in focus and narrow in appeal. Because we in the Green Party don't just care about the fabric of our natural world, vital though that is. We care about the fabric of our public services, the fabric of our communities, the fabric of our unbalanced, vulnerable and dysfunctional economy. So yes, we are the party for people who care about the planet and our own precious environmental resources. But we are also the party for those who care about their fellow human beings, for those who want an economy that offers everyone decent work and the opportunity for self-development, and for those who want a democracy that works and can make people proud of their country. British politics is in a state of flux. There is much talk of realignments. I believe that the progressive, responsible, mobilising values and ideas of green politics can and must be at the heart of the new politics that we so desperately need. But the Green Party also needs a broader platform for another reason. Simply, we cannot now build a better future for Britain through piecemeal change by attempts to ameliorate the consequences of a broken system. A successful, sustainable country can't be achieved simply by demanding better policies on renewable energy or waste or air quality, vital as all of those are. Social justice, which is our responsibility to each other today, and environmental justice, our responsibility to the planet, to nature, and to future generations, are inextricably linked. And a country that works for the 21st century and works for its citizens will be one that has reimagined its approach to the environment, but has also reimagined a fair and cohesive society, reimagined an economy that offers dignity and opportunity, reimagined a powerful, engaged democracy, and reimagined as well the relationship between all of these two. It is not simply policy change that we need, it is system change, a new story of national pride and renewal. And if our focus is the future, then there is one challenge that stands out more than any other. We live in an era of unprecedented technological change and scientific advance. And just as the Industrial Revolution and the mass production revolution transformed life in the 19th and 20th centuries, so in my lifetime, the internet has changed everything, from the way we do business to the way we make friends. But most people think the next wave, the fourth industrial revolution, will be the most significant of all. Those who are pessimistic warn of mass unemployment, escalating inequality, all-pervasive surveillance capitalism, robots taking over. The optimists promise a step change in human fulfillment and freedom, and the capacity to solve challenges ranging from cancer to climate change. Rightly governed, rightly directed, rightly integrated technology does have the scope to transform our world and our lives. And in case anyone thinks Greens are technophobes, let me underline that technology is a vital part of how we address the accelerating climate crisis. But despite the opportunities, most people now say they feel pessimistic about the impact of technology on their work and on their lives. So whether technology serves the purposes only of a small number of super-rich individuals running and investing in global corporations and those authoritarian leaders of undemocratic states, or whether it's directed to the needs of our people and our planet, may be one of the most important issues humanity now faces. It's one that cannot be addressed without questioning the driving logic of our economy and renewing our democratic governance of that economy. After all, even the Conservative government now accepts the principle of an industrial strategy directed towards national goals. So renewing democracy can help us democratize our economy. Deliberative processes, including ones organized by the RSA on AI, for example, have shown citizens can make very thoughtful judgments about the dilemmas thrown up by technological change. And what's more, technology can be part of how we renew democracy, as we're seeing with experiments in large-scale public engagement in cities from Minnesota to Seoul to Madrid. But the way we do democracy now is too narrow. It's too slow, it's too timid, it's too centralized to engage with technological opportunities and the threats on the rapidly approaching horizon. So we need institutional innovation to match technological innovation, starting with our democratic institutions. Even in these bleak and volatile times, if we look hard, we can see the better future which is waiting to be realized. Appreciating that challenge and the opportunity of true sustainability can give us the compass points to the future. Democratic reform can help us chart the course. Thank you.
David, over to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation to respond on this really important theme. Maybe slightly disappointingly, I don't really dissent with anything that Caroline said. I am persuaded, and partly persuaded by the work that Matthew's done here, that our democracies desperately need what deliberation can bring. And I'm also persuaded that, as currently constituted, our democracies are not up to the challenge of the climate emergency. But I want to say something about that last point, because it's a difficult thing to think about in a world in which many people, for many different reasons, are questioning whether our democracies are up to the challenge, and they don't all have either democracy's best interests at heart or the climate's best interests at heart. And I think there's an inevitable and understandable defensiveness about being seen to criticize democracy at a time when it is under such threat from so many different sources. And I think it produces a kind of uncertainty about how to respond. So I want to give just one example, and this is from someone who I think spoke here a couple of weeks ago, David Wallace Wells. He's the author of The Uninhabitable Earth, which is a bestseller, a recently published book about, in his words, the hellscape we face on current trajectories of warming. So not worst-case scenarios, but on current trajectories. He describes a world in a generation at most two, which will be, in some fundamental respects, uninhabitable. So it's an apocalyptic book. And it has many critics who say that this kind of apocalyptic description of our future is fundamentally, leaves us unable to know how to respond. It's disabling. It breeds fatalism and pessimism. It leaves people feeling powerless. And in response to that challenge, this is in an interview he gave in The Guardian, someone said to him, after reading your book, why would anyone think it was worth doing anything? And he says, no, my book is a call to arms. It tells us that we must act, and we must act now. And the interviewer said, well, what should we do? And he said, I quote, just vote. That isn't good enough. If the future we face is the one that he describes, why would just voting be good enough to tackle it? For some of the reasons that Caroline described. Voting is an incredibly crude form of politics. We know that elections are haphazard and often random events that produce surprising results. And even if we get the people we want elected, just electing them doesn't guarantee that they will deliver on what we elected them for, because they then have to run it through these well-established political systems. So what he's essentially saying, I think, to an American audience is vote for people who are advocating a Green New Deal. And if enough of you do that, we'll be okay. I'm not sure that's right. I'm not sure that if enough people vote for a Green New Deal, A, it'll win, and B, even if the people who advocate it win, they will be able to deliver it. And yet, I understand why he's saying it, because voting has become our proxy for political agency, because it is so incredibly valuable. It is a necessary condition of democratic life. You can't really have democracies in the modern world without all citizens being able to vote. But it is not a sufficient condition. And yet it's become a kind of proxy for the whole package. Voting has come to mean mobilization and democratic communication and the political parties who offer us the programs that we can choose between. And that has come for many people to mean democracy, so to be seen to criticize that is to open the door to the many people in the world who would like to abolish democracy. And yet, and I'll do this as briefly as I can, that is not the only story to tell about democracy. That is a relatively recent story, and it's a very contingent story. So I'll just very quickly, I think there are three stories you can tell about democracy. One is the long story, which goes back 2,500 years to the ancient world, where the fundamental democratic values are democratic equality. None of us is born with the right to rule each other. None of us have endowments or entitlements. We're all capable of doing it, and collectively we're capable of mastering our fate. That's a millennial-old story. There's the 250-year-old story, which is the story of representative democracy. The basic ideas that came out of the French and American revolutions, that we will create a class of people, let's call them politicians, who will take decisions for us, but we will choose them, and then they will choose for us. And it's a division of labor story, because we don't actually want to do that, because we've got better things to do with our lives. We're busy, active people in the modern world. We want to franchise that out. And then there is the 50 or 100-year story, which is the thing that we think of as democracy. Full enfranchisement, mass communication, welfare states, a contract between the people and their politicians, professional political parties and professional politicians offering these programs, seeking to achieve power through elections. That story happens to coincide with our lifetimes, but it's not much longer than that. It's relatively recent. Now, I think it's possible that that story is coming to an end, that that story is coming to the end of its useful life. Not all of it, but parts of it. It's a 20th century story. I think it's even possible that the 250-year story is running into trouble, because it's based on an assumption that education and information are scarce resources. Only a few people have access to them, and they will be our governors. And that is not true anymore. But the 2,500-year story is not done. It would be very weird and unlikely that we would be the people alive when that one finishes. But it's not that improbable that we or some of us might be alive when the shorter story runs out of road. But because we think the shorter story is democracy, we are very, very wary of saying it. I'm wary of saying it. I mean, which bits of that do I want to abolish? I don't want to abolish any of it. And yet, what if it is fundamentally inadequate to this task? What will we do? And this is, in a sense, a question for Caroline and for Matthew, which is, you both say, and again, I understand it, that deliberation is there to supplement and enhance and, in some sense, revive and rescue that most recent iteration of democracy. What if, by hooking it onto that, we actually do not allow it to deliver because that is in real trouble? Now, I think it's a really difficult question to ask, never mind to answer, but I think it's a real question. And if I had to say what my anxiety is here, and this is what I'll finish with, it's not a cheery thought. My anxiety here is that the great success story of liberal representative constitutional democracy organized around professional political parties offering programs using mass communication and organized around elections, the 20th century success story of democracy, one of its great merits was that it serves really effectively as a warning system when things are about to go wrong. So these democracies aren't always the best at coming up with the right solution first time round or even second time round, but they're very, very good at hearing the bad news faster than any rival system. Famously, you do not get famines under this kind of politics. I'm not sure this challenge, the climate emergency, fits that model. So if you ask the question, how would we be behaving if in 50 years' time we were facing the hellscape that David Wallace Wells describes? My deep anxiety is we'd be behaving like this. That's why he's written the book. If what he says in that book is true, the information is all out there, we know it, and here we are behaving like this. And like this, I mean our politics. What if the warning signals aren't working? What if we could carry on like this long past the point where we needed to act? I completely recognize the need for all the things that Caroline talked about, and this system needs all of that. But, and I say this as someone who, you know, I'm not radical, I don't think. And I was advocating votes for six-year-olds partly to suggest that this system is so impermeable, it wouldn't actually make that much difference if six-year-olds had the vote. But Extinction Rebellion poses a different kind of challenge about other forms of democratic politics which are much more radical and much more direct. And I think we have to be open to that possibility too, that as we move forward through the next generation or more, there are points at which we mustn't think that democratic reform is all about rescuing this form of politics. We have to be open to the possibility that the 2,500-year story has still got a long, long way to run, and we can be collectively masters of our own fate. But even the 250-year story, and certainly the 50-100-year story, at some point will need to be replaced by something else. Thanks.
So, David, you asked the question. I'll answer that, and then I'll ask a couple of questions of my own before I open it out. I think that my response to your point about if you hook deliberative democracy to representative democracy, is the danger that it discredits the former? That I think, as Caroline argued in the speech, deliberation very directly addresses the problem. It's not sticking lipstick on a pig. It's not saying, well, this is rubbish, but let's attach some baubles to it; it'll be fine. I think deliberative does address the particular problems, and one of them, which again Caroline mentioned, which is a kind of activist capture, which is that it puts the representative citizenry at the heart of politics. And whereas I think one of the real problems we've got now, and we just would not be where we are today if this wasn't the case, is the way in which politics, the way in which political parties in particular, have been captured by activists, and that then leads to a particular kind of outcome. So anyway, I'm not here to answer questions, I'm here to ask them. I've got three questions then, and then we'll open up. So the first one is this, and I'll ask you to answer first, Dave, and then to come. I mean, I have always been an enthusiast for deliberation, but I've come to believe in the last few months and years that I think that democratic reform is the most likely way in which we get to change where we are now. So I understand that there are profound issues around the nature of the economy and the model of capitalism we have. There are profound issues about people's unease with the modern world and whether or not people can cope with diversity and the pace of change. All that stuff, really hard stuff. And that's incredibly difficult to address. There are actually relatively straightforward things you could do to make democracy work better. But the problem is that the whole notion of democratic reform is boring and nerdy. You know, so one of the difficulties is that, you know, if you stand up and say we've got to address inequality, we've got to tackle, you know, if you were in a different kind of audience, tackle immigration or whatever, people would say, yes, yes, that's the problem. But you say, well, actually, it's about a set of changes to our voting system and devolving power and all this. It immediately feels like it's the obsession of a small number of people who care about this stuff. Can we make democratic reform something that interests ordinary people, mobilises ordinary people? That's my question. Caroline?
I bloody well hope so. Otherwise, we've got a lot of problems. I mean, I think. Sorry to come straight to Brexit quite so quickly, but Brexit showed that people want to have a say. And I think you could make the case that if we had had a fairer voting system where people were having a say along the way, and if that kind of warning system, as you described it, was working better, we might never have ended up with Brexit. That's a controversial thing to say, but I think you could make that case that it could be plausible in the sense that quite a lot of the grievances which led to Brexit could have been addressed in the interim before we got to that moment of kind of a pressure cooker where it kind of boiled over. And that sense that people had that vote and they were going to use it because they knew that it counted. And it counted in a way that people don't believe that it counts in a general election. And they're quite right to make that assumption. We know in the last general election, I think it was 68% of all votes cast essentially didn't make a difference to the outcome because they were stacking up in constituencies where already enough votes had been cast to get someone over the line under first past the post. So I think there are ways of making governance interesting. Definitely not if you're talking about Standing Order 6, little 5.2, no. But if it's actually about who has power, that, I think, was a narrative that did interest people quite a lot over the last few years. So if you were to frame it like that, I think we'd get an awful lot more people interested in it.
And David, you were part of a piece of work, a very good piece of work, I think it was the Hansard Society, did around...
The Constitution Unit,
around kind of what we should learn about when to hold referenda and how to hold referenda. I mean, do you think that if ever we get through Brexit, there will be a desire in the public to say that we need to learn profound lessons about all of this, about how we do our democracy? Or do you think that people will just say, oh, we've had enough of it until the next general election?
No, I think it's definitely an opportunity to get... You'd be hard-pressed to find people who think it's going well on any side. I do think, though, that a big part of the challenge, as you set it out there, is that the conception of what democracy is and how it can deliver radical change is people offering radical programs and winning elections to deliver those programs. And so that the people who really want change want their people to get in next time. And we still spend too much time thinking that the next election will fix it. And to try and persuade people, I mean, this is the challenge, that is not the radical approach. I mean, trying to get Bernie or Jeremy or whoever elected is not the radical approach because that's just an election and those people will still operate within a system which will constrain them and limit them and frustrate them and you in all sorts of ways. And actually to think really hard about what it would be to deliver the change you want means getting past waiting for your people to win. But I think we're not there yet. I mean, even with the Brexit issue, we're not there yet, because what people are waiting for is their next chance to undo the thing that they didn't like, or to confirm the thing that they did like, or to have a general election.
Well, that takes me really neatly to my next question, which is, you know, as Caroline said, it is unprecedented to have the combined popularity rating that Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May can muster at the moment. I mean, it's never happened before. I mean, they've got a combined approval rating about 30% or something. Is this a crisis of leadership, or is it simply that it doesn't matter who'd be leading, you know, it doesn't matter who's in charge, because what they're reflecting is, I mean, Ben Page, you quoted Ben Page, I mean, Ben Page says, the problem is this, you've got economically still the kind of left-right divide. It still exists. It's still real. But then you cut across that a kind of liberal authoritarian divide, and it cuts across both parties in half. And so, therefore, there's almost no position that you can stand in which works right now. So is that true, or I'm not asking you to comment on the individuals, or is there something going on about the quality of leadership? Not just, of course, in politics, but corporate sector. I mean, you know, leaders as a whole are not very popular, apart from at the RSA, of course.
I mean, I definitely think that the fundamental political divisions we have do not map onto the political system that we have, generational, educational, authoritarian, so on. I mean, none of that, there aren't parties that can speak for those people. You know, the most astonishing recent piece of polling is, as you say, no one likes either of the two main parties or their leaders, and yet when they're polled, how will you vote in the next election? We're still, the independent group has changed it a bit, but we're still at roughly 80%. 80% of people will freely pick one of these two parties, and something like 70% of people say they don't represent our views.
Freely pick is quite a loaded term. I'm not sure they're freely picking. I think they are working within the system.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with the point that you were making. You know, is our democracy, could it be reformed in such a way that we could take the incredibly bold decisions that we're going to need to take incredibly fast if we're to have any hope of avoiding David Wallace Wells's hellscape? That is a very real question, and I don't know quite what the answer is. I'm hoping so, but there are certainly things we could be doing to our democratic system that could make it a hell of a lot better bet that it might be able to. And so, you know, this kind of thing that looks like it's completely contradictory, that why would people vote for these two main parties? Well, they do, because we have an electoral system that forces them to do it. We've got these two huge parties, really, that have such variety within them, and we're seeing that's, you know, obviously being strained at the edges now, with Ken Clark and Boris in one party and Jeremy and until recently Chucker in the other. You know, if we had a proportional system, then we would have a much greater variety of numbers of parties out there who would then form coalitions, making it clear in advance what the issues were around red lines and what weren't, so you wouldn't have a Nick Clegg tuition fees moment. You would know in advance where the likely common ground was going to be. But I think that would go some way to enabling people to actually vote for what they believe in. And I know this is boring, but there's a wonderful website called Vote for Policies. You probably know it. And people are invited to vote blind for which policy they like best out of a section, you know, a selection of, say, 10 policies on education or health or the environment. They don't know which party those policies belong to. And then they're told at the end that it's computed. And, of course, I'm telling this story because they come out wanting Green Party policies. Okay, so why are people not voting Green? Because why the heck would you in most places under this electoral system? But that doesn't have to be the way it is.
A last question for me, but it's a very a different thing, which is that one way of thinking about how we get out of where we are now is that you just need real boldness. You need an idea that captures people's imagination and suddenly makes things possible. You've did a programme recently on the Green New Deal in your excellent podcast. I'm kind of interested in, I mean, the phrase New Deal's devalued in Britain because Gordon Brown used it for every single initiative. He had a New Deal for libraries, you know. But notwithstanding that, what was your perspective when you did the programme at the end of it? Is the Green New Deal, as it's talked about in America, which is one of those kind of system, you talked about a system reform, that is a kind of system reform idea. You know,
Can I just say it did start in the UK, a group of nine of us in 2007, and then I'm very delighted that, of course, AOC's taken it up and done amazing things with it.
Well, well done for that.
Just for the record.
Yes. So, but what is your sense that there is a possibility still where we are, that a big idea, in the way that's what you need, an idea that is so big that people go, okay, forget everything else, let's try it.
Yeah, I do, and I think the Green New Deal could be it, but the challenge with the Green New Deal and the way it's framed, the fact it's called the Green New Deal, is it's trying to funnel that big idea through the familiar structures and rhythms of American politics. And it's possible that idea will not fit through that. So there is that kind of chicken and egg issue here. Maybe the big idea is the thing that will produce the system change, but it is possible that this system will block that idea. And it is that fundamental dilemma of 21st century politics. Is it different or not? Can we actually, because, you know, so many progressive reforms in the 20th century worked, the imaginative leaders did pull it off, the people who built the coalitions that didn't seem to be there. And yet this time might be different, and also climate might be different. I mean, it must at least be possible that it is the kind of challenge that we have never faced before. And if we try and run it through 20th century politics, the politics might defeat us.
And then, final question for you, Caroline, because it's a bit unfair, I know, but you're on the stage and there's nothing you can do about me asking this question, which is, we may see in the next few months a regrouping around the kind of progressive centre of British politics. Forget centre, just, you know, we've got new Liberal, we have a new leader of the Liberal Democrats, we've got the independent group. There's a quick question mark. Could that be a movement, whatever it coalesces there, that is green in a way that the centre hasn't necessarily been in the past, but it is a bit in Germany, the German Greens. Do you think that's possible? Is that something which the Green Party would like, a conversation you'd like to be a part of? I'm not talking about electoral pacts or anything like that, but trying to say, well, if there is a new politics emerging, it could be green.
I would love to say yes, and I promise you I'm not saying this just to be perverse or to, you know, feel that I own the idea, because if green politics is to have any chance of succeeding, it's got to be something that is spread right across the political spectrum. But I have seen nothing from this new group that says new politics to me in terms of their operation, in terms of their policies. I went through Chucker's new manifesto, and just for a bit of a laugh, I did a word search for the word environment, just out of interest. And it came up five times, some of which were kind of like, in today's hostile environment or whatever. So, you know, there really wasn't any sense that the big challenges that we face going forward are going to be essentially the challenge of how we live and thrive in a world of finite resources. So I hope what will happen if we have the new leader of the Lib Dems, and if this group becomes bigger, the pressure for changing the electoral system, I think, will become much, much greater, because, you know, the Tiggers aren't going to go far unless they have a different electoral system. And if their voices are added to that, then that's good for me. But I don't see hope there, but I did just want to say something hopeful, because that hasn't been a lot, which is just, I don't think we should forget. And Andrew Sims did something on this morning with the new transition network that he works with. Just the moments in the past where we have turned on a threepenny bit to make things better, or at least change things, you know. So, actually, this isn't a very good example, because we weren't making things better, but we were in the war suddenly changing, you know, factories that have been producing cars into factories that produced armaments and other things. We changed incredibly fast over the war because the threat was shared. It was, you know, there was that shared sense of what that threat looked like in a way that we're still struggling a little bit with climate change. Or when, you know, he had some lovely figures about the number of hundreds of miles of railways that were laid in just 7 years, you know, just like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of railways were built in that time. And there are moments that we can look back in our past and say that in certain conditions, the human race can get its act together in certain ways.
Of course, one of the things that you don't have to worry about too much in war is democracy. So that's why you can build so many railways and do so many different things, because you just tell the public they've got to get on with it. So anyway, let's open it up for comments from around the room. Let's take a whole lot and then we'll bring David and Karen back in. So we'll start here and then we'll go there. If you could tell us your name, would be great.
Hi, I'm David Wood from London Futurist. Which experiment, which topic would you pick as the next experiment in deliberative process here in Britain in order for people to become more comfortable with it, that it wasn't a terribly horrible, disruptive idea? Would you do this on figuring out the Green New Deal, or would you do it on proportional representation, or is there something else that you would say is a simpler and a more practical step forwards?
Great, thank you. And then there was somebody there. Yep.
My name's John Percival, and why don't we do something really popular, like vote for the end of party politics, and then step at a time, do something good after that.
Okay, good. Okay. Back there. Yeah. Are there any women going to put their hands up at all? Oh, yes, very good. Thank you. Starting to get worried. Yep.
Shall I go ahead? Steve Kenzie from the UN Global Compact Network UK. Another revelation from Brexit, I suppose, is our perhaps the existence of alternative universes in terms of Caroline. You mentioned if we had the common set of evidence, we'd reach perhaps the same conclusion. But Guardian readers and Daily Mail readers are perhaps dealing, you know, in possession of very different sets of evidence. And so, how do we reconcile? And get to a common set of facts so that we could start to perhaps find some common ground.
I might respond to that in terms of deliberation, but yeah, yes, here. We'll take two more, then you've got 1 minute each, and we can have one more round before we... Yeah.
Hello, my name is Ina Balik. Thank you very much, first of all, for this very inspirational talk. I really much enjoyed that. One point I wanted to make, I think the language we use in this debate is relatively important. So we always talk about a broken system. I'm actually more an advocate for saying we have a fixed system and this is why nothing moves. I think it's time about to actually break the system so we can shove the debris away and make room for new solutions. And I would like to get your opinion on shifting the language in the debate, which I think will shift mindsets.
Okay, thank you. And then here. Yep.
John Bryant, I mean, one of the things that I was expecting to hear but didn't hear much from the earlier speakers was the idea of localism, because if you actually revolutionise local government in this country by making it, one, more powerful in terms of revenue-raising powers, and secondly, made it genuinely representative by having fair votes for it, it becomes more relevant, more people would vote for it, it may become more deliberative. We may get some of the local solutions to some of our the big challenges by experimental programs at local level, which will then teach our centralised politicians a trick or two.
Great, I think Karen, I did mention that. Right, okay, I'm going to answer what. Just in terms of deliberative processes, the way they work is that they're given information from a variety of different sources beforehand. They all have the same information from a variety of sources and they come together for the deliberative process. So one of the advantages of the deliberation is that the citizens who participate all look at the same stuff, but they look at stuff which is across the kind of spectrum of different views. That's one of the things that works about it. Okay, just pick one or two points very quickly. We've got time for another round very quick. You know, we have one.
So I'll quickly do two. Yeah. I completely agree. I wouldn't call it, fixed makes it sound too much like a conspiracy, but I think it's frozen. Yeah. I think it's stuck. And I agree, we should break it. I mean, it's our fear of breaking something that's stuck that keeps us stuck. And we need to be more imaginative, and actually we need to have more courage around that. What would I do is the... I mean, it's hard, but I do think that we're all increasingly aware that the role that the big technology companies play in our lives is very, very potentially threatening, but also we're increasingly dependent. And it's a real issue for people, for parents, for children, cuts across generations. Politicians are struggling to know how to talk about it. People are struggling to understand the nature of what we could do. How extensive are our powers? Are governments as dependent as we are? That's where I would start, that question. How do you regulate technology monopolies?
So I'm going to disagree with you about the fixed versus stuck. I think fixed is a very good word, and I don't think you have to be a conspiracy theorist to recognise that there are vested interests in, you know, in the status quo, or whether it's the... you know, the fossil fuel companies, or whether it's the people who benefit from first past the post, but there are vested interests. And so I think that language is incredibly important, and I shall now use fixed going forward. I think that's very helpful. The other phrase I hate...
And then it'll all change, and tonight will be the moment.
The other one was the one I hated, you know, the famous left behind, as if they'd just kind of fallen down the back of the sofa by mistake, rather than that it's actually a function of a system of globalisation that depends on there being winners and losers. So I'm really with you on that. Localism, I completely agree, and I touched on it very briefly when I was talking about the fact that mayors have made an awful lot more progress on this issue than prime ministers by and large. But yes, you're completely right, more powers to local authorities, and people can see the impact of the way they cast their votes. They've got far greater engagement with their local representatives and so on. Just on the issue of the different varieties of evidence in front of you, I mean, the key thing, of course, just to add, and I think it's probably what you were getting at too, is about regulating the adverts on Facebook and so forth, political adverts, because at the moment, you know, at the minute, at least if you have the Telegraph and the Daily Mail or the Mirror or whatever, you can see the range of different information that people are getting. But with these dedicated Facebook advertisements, you've got no idea what other people are seeing, and so you don't even know the kind of the spectrum of yeah, lies.
So I'll stop you there, because I know you've got a vote, so you've got to go. But I did promise another round. These are going to be incredibly tight questions, and I'm going to find another woman. I am going to find another woman. No, I'm not. Yes, I am. There.
Hello, my name's Gail, and I'm from Swap It Up. I think there was a tremendous amount of energy that occurred on Friday with the young people that gathered to march on the climate change. I don't think we've really touched on that at all tonight, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on what we can do to springboard from that energy and to start giving them some of the answers and solutions that they're looking for.
Very good, thank you. Yep, and here.
Well, I think climate change definitely is a very global problem, and right now we've been talking a lot about national politics and national systems of not well, democracy, how everything works. So I was wondering what, in your view, if something needs to change in national political systems or national politics in order to realize that we need to tackle this on a global level rather than on this rather national and maybe quite, restrictive level you we're doing
have,
right now.
You may have noticed we're going slightly in the opposite direction at the moment, but yes, absolutely. And then, right, and then you'd have to choose somebody. And then I'll be less unpopular with the person who wasn't chosen.
Charlie Waterhouse, you both made very welcome but fleeting mention of the Extinction Rebellion. And my question to you is very simple. Will you join us on the streets of London on the 15th of April?
Oh. Go on then. I'll give you as long as I could to decide how to answer that one.
So I'll give an answer that touches on all of them. So my feeling is, though more deliberation would be welcome, if you look at the bigger picture here, the climate emergency is probably going to require more democracy and more radical democracy and more direct democracy and more of this kind of direct action. And it will probably, at some levels, including at some aspects of global international governance, be less democratic. It may be more technocratic. It may require collaboration with non-democratic regimes. We think that democracy is this all-or-nothing thing. We hold on to it, or we end up in the world of the 1930s again. It's coming apart anyway, and we have to decide which bits we want to hold on to, which bits we might have to give up, and which bits we want to add to it. And part of what we have to add to it, I'm convinced, is more direct action.
Final.
That's
word.
Not a direct answer to your question. I'm not sure what I'm doing on the 15th.
Final word to you, Caroline.
Thank you. Well, I was at, I think, the very first Extinction Rebellion demonstration, and I will be very happy, subject to diary commitments, to be at the next one. I'm a complete supporter of what Extinction Rebellion is doing. I'm also a great supporter of taking peaceful direct action. I've done it and thankfully was acquitted when it came to a court case. I think that the climate strikers are doing an amazing job. I mean, the idea that one 16-year-old girl a year ago could have triggered what is now in over 71 countries, I think is just, whenever anyone says to you an individual can't change things, I mean, this is just extraordinary. So I think that's great. I just wanted to say something about what that means for our political system, because what I've observed before when we've had things like the Occupy movement and so forth is that those movements have been fantastic at getting issues on the political agenda and putting focus on them, but they've been less good at actually helping to resolve them. And so if we had more time, it'd be really interesting to look at that relationship between the direct democracy and the direct action on the streets and how that actually translates into change that enough people are signed up to in terms of making that actually happen. Because I come back to the point that I said earlier, that I think there will be really hard choices to be made. I just made a little film with Franny Armstrong last week that was to mark the 10th anniversary of The Age of Stupid, that film that she made all about climate change 10 years ago. And we were doing a little kind of what if we had actually taken the right action. And one of the things in it was an announcement being made that there was going to be one more flight that everybody could take so they can go and say goodbye to their family who might be on the other end of this world. And this meant a lot to me because my son is studying in California and it really came home. If we're serious, what are we going to do about aviation? We don't have any technological fixes for aviation yet. How are we going to get people to say maybe one more flight, folks, and that's it until there is the technological breakthrough that we need to find a way of flying in a way that doesn't massively heat the planet? I don't know what the answer is to that, but somehow we are going to need a bloody good deliberative process, Matthew, that is going to mean that people are going to say, yep, we're going to give up flying for a while.
Well, thank you. We'll be continuing this conversation here at the RSA around democratic reform, and we talked about deliberation today, we talked about electoral reform, we've talked about devolution. I think for the RSA, a critical question that we keep wanting to come back to is how do you encourage greater participation in society, greater participation in our democracy, in our economy, in society? It's a big theme for us, so please watch our look at our website, come back to future events. If you want to hang around now and continue the conversation, please go down to our Rolf Mills coffee shop afterwards. But thank you for joining us, thank you for your questions, and please join me in thanking Caroline and David.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.